You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, yesterday's EgyptAir crash and the media's response. Much of it inane, some of it downright distasteful. How should newspapers cover a disaster, especially when they're not sure what the story actually is? Also ahead.
From the shelter of the British flag, our cameraman in Hong Kong looks into Red China. A country of fanatical communism.
China's leadership has made tentative, if not reluctant, steps towards confronting the country's past. Why is history such a hard thing to own up to? Also coming up.
What you have is you've now got government by proxy of everybody who has now got carried away. And I think unless there's some extremely significant changes, we should get out.
Members of Britain's capering and pretending trades have expressed their opinion about EU membership. But is there any reason why we should care what actors think about anything? Clue, no. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Monocle 24's executive producer Tom Edwards and Monocle's business editor Matt Alagaya. Welcome both. We will start with yesterday's loss of EgyptAir flight MS-804, or at least of the media reaction to it. No story exposes the weakness of 24-hour rolling news or the hysteria of social media like an air disaster. This is because everybody knows instantly one big and terrible thing, which is that an airliner has crashed, but it is often days, even weeks before anybody really knows much more than that. So the interim gets filled with speculation, hearsay, rumour, conspiracy theory, and earnest discussions like these of the media's reaction to air disasters. Matt, first of all, it's a strange, peculiar little fantasy of mine, perhaps, but just once in circumstances like this, I wonder what would happen if one rolling news channel just said, we know a plane's crashed, we don't actually know much more than that, we probably won't for some time, we'll get back to you when we do.
Absolutely, it would be great if they could do that, but unfortunately they have to fill the minutes and the seconds every hour, which means that they have to come up and they have to conjecture and they have to constantly speculate on what might have happened, and it does seem to have also kind of filtered into the newspapers as well, which is a bit troubling.
It does. We have before us a table full of front pages from Britain, the US, and indeed Europe and the Middle East, around the world in fact. Tom, what have you made of the selection of Britain's more excitable newspapers that you have over there?
Well, the table here in Studio One, Andrew, is almost being weighed down by the hyperbole contained within. What really strikes me as particularly disappointing is not that, the Mirror or the Daily Star, I've even got a Daily Express here.
Is that
still going? But no, there's no surprise that we have, histrionics, white on black headlines, real shouty stuff with blown out of the sky and all this kind of thing. What disappoints me is that an august, supposedly, newspaper like The Times has a, frankly, rather extraordinary front page graphic representation of, yes, a plane crashing from 37,000 feet. And I guess what really depresses me about this is the notion that one hopes the moderately intelligent reader to whom the Times newspaper is pitched can imagine what might happen and what might be involved in a plane crashing without having to have a graphic that literally has a picture at the bottom of, parts of a plane breaking up and the waves kind of crashing against it. It's kind of needlessly detailed and, frankly, rather crass.
It's a strange one, isn't it? Because it's not. You can understand how a newspaper can overcook its coverage of anything under extreme pressure, on tight deadlines, etc., etc. People get carried away. It can't always be helped. They would have had all day yesterday. This plane crashed very, very early yesterday morning. They would have had all day to think about this. And incredibly, for as you say, a very serious, a very intelligent, usually very good newspaper like The Times, nobody has taken a look at that front page and gone, is this overselling it somewhat.
The trouble is, Andrew, look, I've sat in newspaper editorial meetings in the morning, and you think, right, well, how do we illustrate this? And maybe they've said, well, we don't want to do an invasive picture of somebody, you know, grieving at an airport, which, believe me, a lot of other newspapers did.
We have had plenty of that thing of people going to the relatives at the airport and asking them how they feel,
and you talked at the top about inanity. How much more inane can it get than asking a relative of someone who's missing in a plane which is presumed to have crashed what they're feeling? I mean, it beggars belief.
It is extraordinary. Matt, you have the German front pages there, or the German newspapers.
I do indeed. I think it's fair to say that, you know, if you looked at the German tabloids, the red tops there, you'd also see similar coverage. But I've picked out two broadsheets, the Süddeutsche Zeitung and the Frankfurter Allgemeine, which are two of the kind of the best broadsheets in Germany. And it's just amazing. I mean, you know, the front covers, both of them, it was obviously the biggest story of the day yesterday, but neither of them have gone with a picture on the front page to illustrate this story. So the Frankfurter Allgemeine goes with, you know, terror suspected after the crash of a plane, a similar headline on the Süddeutsche as well. And it's only inside that we see any pictures. And even the pictures inside are very, you know, tastefully done, I would say. You know, the Frankfurter Allgemeine has the minister in Egypt who made the call. And I think it's a much more sensitive way of dealing with it.
The Egyptian newspapers, interestingly, have been fairly restrained, which they are not always in covering foreign news, especially. Al-Masri Al-Yum has had a basic factual summary of events. They've done a slightly, perhaps, oversold human interest story on an employee of Charles de Gaulle Airport who says she regrets helping a family who were late to board the plane. Al-Akhbar and Al-Aram have... it's all very cagey. They're all hedging their bets. I mean, how... But I guess, Tom, how nervous are the Egyptian press likely to be about getting this wrong? They will be aware that the world scrutiny is on Egypt for less than desirable reasons once again.
Well, this is it. And it's kind of on two fronts that they'll be worried about this. First, of course, it wasn't that long ago that we had, a passenger aircraft that was downed, as we know subsequently, by a bomb that was placed on board within the Egyptian borders. And that's obviously damaged their reputation in terms of security management, but also as a tourist destination. And also...
That slightly bizarre hijack a few weeks ago as well, which turned out to be not really.
But this is the thing. But it suggests that people are losing faith. And I think that, you know, the Egyptian newspapers are cagey because, you know, this is a country that's going to be worried about the impact that this has. And frankly, whether it's a security breach... Even if it's not a security breach within Egyptian borders, if it happened in Tunisia, if it happened in Paris, we don't know and we shouldn't speculate. It's going to do damage to Egypt as a tourist destination. And so I think the papers are necessarily having to kind of tread, you know, walk on eggshells around their coverage of this for that reason.
And Matt, what have you made of how, I guess, the agencies involved in this, from Egypt Air to the Egyptian and Greek officialdom in particular, and the French officialdom, have played this? How much more difficult, I guess, is dealing with a situation like this now than it might have been 20 years ago before the 24-hour news cycle is what was it was, or even 10 years ago before social media is what it was? What do they still need to do more of or less of?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, as you say, 20 years ago, you might have said something wrong in a press conference, and you could call up the newspapers and make sure that the message got out there correctly. I think now you have to be so careful about what you say, and you can kind of see that with a lot of these conferences that they're having and the announcements that are being made by people like François Hollande. They are being very careful, and they don't want to speculate at all. And I think that's part of this. It's the fact that if you say anything wrong, it's on social media within seconds. If you say anything slightly speculative, then it'll be, you know, broadcast live around the world instantly.
Okay, well, we will move on now, and indeed we will move seamlessly along on the subject of media struggling to cover an awkward story. China's media this week made a valiant attempt to ignore the 50th anniversary of the launch of the Cultural Revolution, along with what turned out to be a misplaced bet that anybody else would notice their dereliction. Following a chorus of harumphing from op-ed pages around the world, such newspapers as the People's Daily and Global Times grudgingly printed some grumpy boilerplate to the effect that they'd already said the Cultural Revolution was bad before, doesn't anybody listen, etc. Tom, do they have, and it's not something I'm often willing to credit the People's Daily and Global Times with, two of the most shockingly tedious newspapers on earth, but do they have half a point here? The official line from the Chinese Communist Party and all official media now, and has been for some time, is that the Cultural Revolution was terrible, it was dreadful, they're not making excuses for it. How long should they keep beating themselves up over it?
Well, I think what struck me as interesting was the fact that you got this, grudging, sort of bad-tempered, understandably po-faced print answer.
To the People's Daily is light on chuckles.
To some of the global scrutiny, because as you suggested in the introduction there, plainly it was going to draw the world's attention, it was going to draw criticism. I'm only surprised that they printed anything. I would have thought it would be exactly as you've just suggested. Look, we've made it clear, we know what happened and we're not getting into it. And frankly, I think it sounds strange to say, they would have almost been better off saying nothing, publishing nothing, and just continuing that same bloody-mindedness.
It's not a uniquely Chinese phenomenon, though, is it, Matt? Every country in the world has that thing somewhere in the attic it doesn't like talking about, which always strikes me as quite strange, because it is usually something committed by people who aren't alive at all anymore. Why is it, I guess, such a human commonplace to get defensive about what our ancestors might have done?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, it's kind of like the sins of the fathers being delivered on the children. It's a strange thing. And I think what's interesting about the Chinese example, I guess, is that there's more of a continuation of the political party, obviously, in that example. So, you know, something like Nazism in Germany, that's clearly, you know, there was a break, and then there was a new generation came along, and there was a lot of criticism, and they're called the 68er generation in Germany, and they criticized their parents, their fathers, and I think that was a moment where Germany reflected, and there was a chance to move on, I guess. There,
Germany's always been pretty good at criticizing itself, though, in fact exemplary in that, where if you compare and contrast that with Japan, which still refuses to admit to itself or to anybody else that a lot of what it, you know, really quite definitively and provably did during the Second World War actually occurred.
Well, I think you can look to popular culture for a lot of this. I think it's interesting that, in Germany, there's great writing. Yeah, there's great philosophizing about all of this, but there's also great satire. There's great films, there's programs, even still now, that are made. Comedies, even, looking back to this time, poking fun, trying to, if you like, use the whole canon of the creative arts to make sense of it. But there are some places where culturally that just doesn't come as easily. And I think, you know, Japan is an example. What strikes me as most interesting about Germany, if we're looking for comparison, certainly around that time in history, is if you look closer to home, just across the border, say,
indeed so,
in Austria, and I know this is something we might come on to, we've got a country that almost essentially failed to engage with its responsibilities or its misdemeanors of that time.
It
still hasn't to this day.
Well, Austria was allowed or permitted for various reasons to think of itself as a victim after the Second World War, rather than a fairly, you know, early enthusiastic collaborator, to the extent that they, you know, they actually elected a former Nazi officer to their presidency in the 1980s. And there is some angst now in Austria about the fact that they may be about to elect on Sunday I think we would charitably describe him as far right. This is Norbert Hofer of the Freedom Party. I mean, Matt, does something like that, and does it become, it is frankly impossible to imagine that Germany would ever elect Chancellor somebody of his positions and statements. Is that the difference between Germany and Austria, that Austria was allowed to feel like none of this was really its fault?
I don't know. I mean, you know, Germany does have a far-right party in Pegida that is pretty dangerous. And
Alternative for Deutschland as well.
Exactly. There are two parties there. I mean, I think Pegida is even more right of Alternative for Deutschland. But these are two very far-right parties, and they are gaining some ground, I think. You know, Austria, I think it would be a little bit complacent, potentially, of Germany to think that it could never happen there. I think what we've seen in Austria is a populist party, effectively, with a populist leader, doing fairly well by saying things that people are feeling. I think there's enough sort of groundswell in Germany for that as well.
Is there, I guess, to advance the counter-argument, which is that dwelling overly on history, and especially on historical injustice, may actually impede progress? You can certainly make arguments for that idea in the Middle East, certainly in the Balkans, and there is a statement about Ireland often attributed to Churchill, though I've never been quite able to stand it up. It sounds like the sort of thing he might have said, though, of Irish history, which is that the English should learn it and the Irish should forget it.
Well, yeah, I think what's interesting as well is there's another statement about history, which is that obviously it's written by the victors, and I think that's an important thing to bear in mind here, because, you know, I think if you look at the United Kingdom or the British experience, whether it's about Ireland, whether you go back to World War II, it is rather different. And I think that's partly because the, I don't know what you describe it as, the victor's mentality drives the historical narrative in a particular direction. And where you have a country, say we talked about Japan earlier, where, you know, dealing with issues of that are, you know, viewed as shameful or disgraceful, even on a micro level, a personal level, or in the world of business, it's so deeply shameful, it's often just left, you know, unacknowledged for decades. And on a huge national level, there simply isn't really the means to deal with it. But then again, you know, Japan was sort of clearly a defeated party in the war. Maybe some of these other countries that were affected tangentially, even though, as you said, the Austrians, maybe enthusiastic early adopters, don't have that sort of, you know, vanquished country. Maybe they feel like they were, you know, collateral damage in a wider conflict.
And just, I guess, to return to Germany, Matt, why do you think they have been so extraordinarily punctilious in dealing with this? And I guess more to the point, why have so few other countries been able to follow that lesson?
It might well be just simply how kind of disastrous Nazism was and how terrible the legacy. I think, you know, when your country has gone through that, and it was inevitable that after Nazism, Germany had to, because it had to deal with it, because so many people were still alive who had effectively either been complicit or actually acted under Nazism. There had to be a kind of a huge cultural and political sort of reevaluation of what it was to be German. And as I say, I think it took a generation in Germany. You know, the 50s were considered this, you know, the economic wonder. That was what happened straight after the war. And then it was their children, the people who came to sort of adulthood in 68, who effectively really challenged their parents and said, look, you know, we actually have to go back and understand what you did. And there was a huge cultural revolution then in Germany, which saw them kind of reassess what their parents had done and what Germany's legacy was.
We will take a short break on that note. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Matt Alagaya and Tom Edwards. Coming up next, actors, musicians, writers and directors are lining up to tell us that Britain shouldn't leave the EU. No word as yet from jugglers or knife throwers. More on that shortly.
The Ocean Fresh June issue of Monocle heads to sea for an outing that unpacks everything from security tussles in the Pacific to what boat you should be rowing across to your lakeside retreat. Here's what our captains have planned for you this time.
In the edit section, we reel in a haul of seaside-themed take-homes and tuck into a steak with the famous graphic designer Bob Gill in New York for his imagined last meal on Earth. Plus, some fresh reporting from Madrid's state-of-the-art fish market and a neighbourhood on the up in Adelaide. We also show our favourite new hotel finds from Santiago to Barcelona and food from San Francisco to Stockholm.
In culture, we go cruising, really cruising, as we take to the Med to profile cruise ship entertainers. They sing, they dance, we get caught in a conga. Elsewhere, we inspect the deep, watery world of Mare, a magazine which takes a philosophical look at the sea before considering why islands make us mad.
Monocle's June issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining us as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Edwards and Matt Alagaya. Take a listen, if you will, to this.
No hold on me.
That was, in no particular order, Paloma Faith, Franz Ferdinand and Pulp, all of whom I think I'm right in saying are quite keen on Britain remaining in the EU. There is still more than another month to go, before Britain votes on whether or not to remain a member of the EU in a bid to regain the attention of that large plurality. Who would put the word plurality in a radio script? It is a shocker, honestly. of the public. I'm going to try that again. That large plurality of the public who zoned out of what has been a monumentally fatuous and annoying debate some months ago, a gaggle of entertainers has been persuaded to put their names to a big letter in favour of staying in. Tom, this happens a lot. This is the bit in a serious political debate where they ask a bunch of people who dress up and read things out for a living what they think. Why should we care?
I'm still reeling, Andrew. I didn't know that Paloma Faith had pitched in, so I'm off to recalibrate my entire, political...
I'm assuming she's for Remain. I haven't really looked into it. Can we get away from the production booth? Do we know? Yeah, no, she's for Remain.
She's for Remain. I find it absolutely staggering. Not that maybe people weigh in. This is a point, I guess, if some kind of, B-list celebrity or even a kind of an A-lister is approached by a journalist to give their views, okay, maybe they're feeling collegiate. They might give them their 10 cents. That's perfectly respectable. Once again, I'm afraid, I don't want to keep bashing the media, but where do they publish this? On the front page of today's Guardian here in the UK, there's a sort of eight faces, montaged up on the front. Oh, these are all the people who've got involved. Why do they think we care? But the depressing reality is that probably might make a difference for some people. And that's probably even more depressing than the fact that the media runs it, is that it might shape someone's views.
See, I bow to no man in my sort of disdain for the level of public discourse. But seriously, Matt, do we actually seriously think that somebody has picked up the newspaper this morning who was tending towards voting out and has thought, oh my God, Keira Knightley saying Remain, this changes everything?
I don't think there's anyone who's going to say that. But
What about Joan Collins, though, Matt? Come on!
But I do think there's potentially something where, you see this many celebrities' faces on the front cover and you're not normally someone who picks up a newspaper, and you don't normally think that the Brexit debate is something you're interested in, but that makes you interested in the debate. I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate
really?
Here, but I think there might be people who think that celebrities have something to say and wouldn't normally pick up a newspaper and actually get involved in the debate, but that brings them into the debate.
Are you saying I'm in a minority and being one of those people who's actually less likely to buy a newspaper if it has those people on the cover?
Shockingly, I think I might be saying that, yes.
Can you, though, at least... Can you judge a political cause, do you think, Tom, by the caliber, if you will, of its celebrity backers?
I'd like to think that you could, but I can't immediately think of any notable examples where that's the case. And I think the problem we've got here, and this is more of a contemporary problem again, we were talking before about, the 24-hour news cycle and social media and how that's compelled people and journalists too to be constantly speculating and to constantly try and be first with the story. It's definitely changed the landscape. I think particularly social media has made it even worse. There's an impatience to have a line. There's an impatience to have, a new voice. And there's simply not the interest in saying, well, actually, that's not important. Why don't we just get someone who's got something really interesting to say about this and maybe get them to write a piece about it? And someone can read 1,000 words tomorrow and actually read an argument that might cause them to kind of recalibrate their opinions. The problem is that the patience isn't there. And what's really depressing is I don't see any change to it. I think people are encouraged to base their opinions on transient things, ephemera that's in the press. Yeah, the fact that Richard Curtis has weighed in. Oh, yeah, seize on that and then just make your decision. It seems ever more difficult to get people, aside from on platforms like our own Monocle 24, to actually listen to some, bit of a punt, marginally more intelligent discussion about it.
Matt, is there a problem of, I guess, level of debate here or even-handedness in that, given that your warblers and thespians tend towards the liberal, are conservative causes at a disadvantage? Because all I've been able to come up with in sort of pro-exit celebrities, and I confess I didn't do that much research on the grounds that I don't really care, are Ian Botham, Sol Campbell and Michael Caine. I mean, they're struggling.
That's not the most shiny list of A-listers, is it? But I think that's a fair point. I think my sense about this is always, I think there is a good cultural argument for staying in the EU. Should these people have a forum for saying that? I think they should be allowed to say what they feel about this. Otherwise, all we get is politicians and political commentators talking about Brexit. And I don't know, cultural figures like this, they do have a point that it's useful being in the EU if you run a cultural institution.
I wonder
or
if it's,
you're in
is,
film.
It, is it the same the world over though, Andrew? Even your motherland, if we were to head down under. There's lots of luminaries in the cultural and certainly in the sporting realm. We've got Beefy, There must be. So what if Punter got involved on the Aussie front? Or Ron Barassi, a legend from Aussie sport? He could change your mind about anything, couldn't he?
He could. He is quite scary, though, in fairness. Barassi is someone, I confess, I would listen to. Finally, tonight, we will look ahead to next week's series here on Monocle 24 on The Globalist, which is examining the bizarrely persistent tobacco trade from the producers and retailers who make and sell it to the people who consume it, to the governments who, by and large, attempt to discourage them from so doing. This is because plain packaging for cigarettes has become mandatory today in the UK, Ireland and France. Here in the UK, it will be packaged in Pantone 448C opaque couche, which is allegedly the world's ugliest colour. Matt, is this...
Pantone 448.
Exactly. Is this literally a cosmetic initiative, or will it make a difference, do you think?
I think it probably will make a difference, and I'm not sure where I stand on this debate, to be honest. It's one of those difficult things. Having seen the packaging that you have in Australia, I think there's something really sinister about it.
It is hideous.
It's
supposed to be, but it's...
Exactly.
But...
It seems to be making people's minds up for them, which is, I mean, I think there needs to be a level of, you need to be careful about this kind of thing, because obviously a lot of things are bad for us and we're allowed to buy them. But this is really, I think, quite sinister.
That's enough crazed libertarian ranting from you, Matt. what do you think, Tom?
No, I'm all in favour of this, actually. I think it's very sensible. And I think the difference, people will say, oh, well, what next? You know, plain packaging of, you know, bottles of wine or beer or automobiles that kill more people, etc., etc., etc. I think the key difference here is you've got to look at the range of merits available from a certain item, and I think it's fairly well acknowledged now by everyone, perhaps outside at the main proponents of the tobacco lobby, that cigarettes are mainly bad and the benefits are confined to a sometimes quite literally short term, because you're maybe not around long enough to continue to do it, a short term high. So unlike alcohol, which can be consumed responsibly, unlike a car, which if driven correctly can be driven responsibly, there are no fringe benefits to me smoking. I still revel daily in the fact that cigarettes have been banned in various public spaces in this country, and I'm all for it.
On the subject of that ban, though, is there something to be said, though, Matt, for just doing things which continually, I guess, literally, in fact, reduce the space in which it can be done? Because it does now seem insane, does it not, that smoking in restaurants was ever allowed at all. I can remember when it used to be allowed on London buses and aeroplanes, cinemas.
I remember planes. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, in the underground as well, which is already pretty dirty and there's not much fresh air down there.
Which now just sort of seems like to be a sort of vestige of a time when, you know, we burned witches. I mean, it seems an extraordinary thing that it was ever allowed to go on. Is that the thing that is eventually going to drive cigarette smoking out, though? Just like gradually sort of making it more and more difficult, expensive and unpleasant?
I think so. I mean, it's interesting. It's kind of part of that debate of the privatisation of public space. There are a lot of, you know, a lot of places that look like public spaces now that are actually, you know, owned by a developer. And interestingly, a lot of them stop you from smoking and, you know, you can't drop your cigarette butts on the floor. And I think you're absolutely right that the amount of kind of public space that we're allowed to smoke in is getting smaller and smaller, and also the weather's really, really cold here, so if you're outside it's not going to be particularly pleasant.
I think the antisocial factor is more important than the price. I'm uneasy about pricing up cigarettes to a lunatic level, principally because I know there are people for whom, you know, it may be the small and limited joy in their day, and as usual with heavily taxed goods, it tends to target the wrong people and maybe punish some more than others, particularly on lower incomes. I think the antisocial thing is key, particularly in this country. I think the more antisocial it becomes, that's the most powerful thing, beyond even the medical warnings and this sort of thing. I think it's the loneliness of the smoker that will erode, that will bring the numbers down.
And do you think that, Matt, finally, that I guess the question that still hangs over my curious head at the end of all this is, why haven't what we now know about the costs of smoking, the health costs of smoking, why hasn't that been enough by itself?
That's interesting. I mean, I think we're dealing with something that has a long cultural heritage here. You know, there are lots and lots of films where very cool people pick up a cigarette and light it off their beard. And that is, you know, that's sadly, everyone will be watching those films. And I think that's kind of why it's quite a long cultural heritage to be tackling.
Well, that is all we have time for on today's show, which was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Faith Barker. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music coming up next. At 1900, you can hear The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and we will have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200 tonight. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening. Have a great weekend and goodbye.